The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 8. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, everyone. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to talk to someone that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He is the host of the best podcast out there, in my opinion, by far. There's not even a close second. That is the Macro Voices podcast. If you guys aren't listening to it, you need to go to iTunes right now, download it, listen to every single episode. There you go. Eric Townsend, thanks for being here, buddy.
It's great. Thanks for having me on, and congratulations on the new channel. You are just exploding in terms of your followers on YouTube.
Yeah, it was a surprise, but it's been a lot of fun. You kind of got the tiger by the tail sometimes with all the comments, but it's a lot of fun. For the viewers that don't know your backstory, do you want to kind of outline that, give them the Reader's Digest version?
Sure. I was a software engineer and entrepreneur in the 90s. I ran a software company. The end of the 90s, valuations were just crazy, and I wasn't ready to be retired, but I was definitely ready to cash in on the crazy valuations that were being paid for IT companies. So I sold the company in 98, and it was the right business decision in the sense of timing the market. Maybe, you know, we were 6 months early at best. We just before the dot-com bust happened. So I got out of the software business in the nick of time. That was a great business decision, but it left me personally not really sure what was next in life. And I went through trying to be retired for a few years. That doesn't work when you're in your 30s. And eventually reinvented myself first as a private investor. Then I went on to run a macro strategy hedge fund for 5 years. So basically, computer geek first, and then hedge fund. And these days I'm kind of going back to a little bit of the computer geek. I'm doing a lot of Python programming and processing market data and doing some custom systematic trading strategy development. So bringing the software skills back into the fray, which I didn't expect to do, but boy, it's changed. Everything's in memory now. You don't have a database. It's all in memory. It's a whole different paradigm of programming than when I retired from the software industry back in 98.
Yeah, so that brings me to my next question. And I think you've got such an incredible background because you're combining not only the tech side of it, but the macro side of it as well. And you came out with a book, and it's called Beyond Blockchain, The Death of the Dollar and the Rise of Digital Currency. And this is something that I talk about a lot. Can you go ahead and expand on that? And I know I loved the name that you gave for the digital currency. You called it the Orwell. And in your book, and I would suggest everyone going out and getting that, but can you expand on that a little further?
Sure. I'll give you the quick thumbnail Reader's Digest version of the book. I think that digital currency is going to dramatically change the world that we live in. I think that over the next 25 or 30 years, we'll have a digital currency revolution, which literally redefines what money itself is. And it's not just money that it will be replacing. It's the entire credit systems, the whole fractional reserve banking system that makes credit possible, I predict will be replaced by a new digital currency, digital monetary system that is more versatile, more flexible, more capable, could be just incredibly positive for society. Unfortunately, it also prevents, or I should say, it presents the opportunity for governments to do a huge power grab. And the reason I call the future currency the Orwell is I think that it's giving the technology that's before us today is giving governments on a silver platter the opportunity to implement a new monetary system, which just makes every penny of wealth that exists anywhere on the planet traceable, so they know who's got it, where they got it from, when they got it, under what circumstances they got it. There's no financial privacy whatsoever. Now, of course, we the people, in theory, the government's supposed to work for us. We could say we don't want it to work that way. We want to have our financial privacy, and we want our government to respect our wishes, and so please do it that way. In the past, governments haven't generally respected the wishes of the populace when it comes to financial privacy. And a lot of people have come around, even though I'm not one of them myself, a lot of people in society in this age of terrorism and risks and so forth have come around to the viewpoint that it's better if the government can control and monitor and track every penny of wealth in existence and know who's got it and where they got it from and so forth. So ironically, although Bitcoin is kind of where it all started, I think that the most likely outcome is that the digital currency systems of the future that define the new monetary world order, if you will have opposite characteristics of Bitcoin. Bitcoin was designed to enhance financial privacy and to make it difficult for government to track and monitor the financial dealings of private citizens. I predict, unfortunately, that the government-sponsored digital currencies of the future will have the opposite attributes. They'll be designed to monitor everything that we do and to track what everybody is up to and to enforce taxes and do all sorts of things. So I think it potentially is a game changer in terms of making credit more available to more people in the world and really advancing civilization. Unfortunately, the risk is government taking it and doing all the wrong things with this new technology. And I think, unfortunately, that's the most likely outcome. Ultimately, you know, it's going to be a question of whether we, the people, step up and say, no, we don't want to tolerate government controlling and monitoring everything that we do through a new digital money system. We insist, because it could very easily be designed to take the approach Bitcoin took and advance that another order of magnitude. So you have a truly private digital financial system where governments don't have any special abilities to track and monitor the affairs of private citizens. I don't think it's going to go that way, unfortunately, but the technology could offer either outcome. So that's kind of what the book is about. And the ironic prediction of the book is, I think that the digital currency revolution of the next 25 years will be bigger than any of the Bitcoin maximalists are predicting. It's going to completely change the world. It's a change on the order of the personal computer or the public internet. It's that big of a deal. Yeah. I don't think Bitcoin is going to be a big part of the story. Like the Wright Flyer, Bitcoin will always be remembered as where it all started. That was the first invention that started it all. You go to the airport today, you don't see Wright Flyers parked out on the tarmac. We've got Boeings and Airbuses and so forth. The future digital currency system probably will not use the blockchain distributed ledger, almost certainly won't, because blockchain is not very efficient. There's better ways of solving the same problem that blockchain solves. And I think that future digital currency systems will be based on much better technology than what Bitcoin and the other current cryptocurrencies are based on. But the biggest prediction is we're going to have this this tug of war between privacy rights, and there are some legitimate arguments that can be made. You know, government wants to enforce terrorism and money laundering and tax evasion and so forth. They could build technology that makes the future government-sponsored digital currency systems very, very invasive on our privacy. And I'm afraid that's the direction we're headed in.
Yeah, it always concerns me when the government does something for your safety. You know, I mean, most people don't realize that that's how they sold the general public on building the Berlin Wall. It was it was for their safety. So I always hesitate. And it's the same thing with currency. You know, currency makes our life a lot better, a lot easier to transact. But once government takes it, they just take it to a level where it actually becomes detrimental. So you talked about with the Orwell, let's call it that, being a way that the government can spy on us. But is there a way, I mean, you really thought this through, is there a way for them to control the actual spending in addition to spying on people? So the way I kind of thought about it in simple terms is if someone went out there and got a DUI, as an example, The government, if they have this digital currency that every single token, if you will, is tracked and can be monitored, they could say, well, okay, well, you just don't, you can't buy alcohol for the next 5 years. And they could enforce that. Is that true or not true?
Oh, it's absolutely true. And the scary part is technology is very capable. You could design a digital currency system to do just about anything. And one of the possibilities is you could give government the ability to seize anyone's money anywhere on earth. So say, you know, they get a court order that says George Gammon has been found out. He's actually an arms dealer. All of his money, anywhere he's got it in the world, we're going to extinguish that money. We're going to block it by clicking a mouse. You could design a digital currency system that gives government that degree of power and authority over everyone's money. Now, you and I could probably agree pretty darn quickly that that's a bad idea. Folks that work in government think it's not just a good idea, but they think it is their patriotic duty to their countries to introduce ideas like this because they think it's the best way to save us, to protect us, to make us safer. I agree with you. The Berlin Wall is a perfect example. The new Berlin Wall is going to be a Berlin Wall of governmental control over money, where the idea now where possession is nine-tenths, if I've physically got my coins and or my dollar bills or whatever in a suitcase and I go hide someplace, I've got it. They're going to have the digital ability to extinguish your money without physically having to make contact with you because all money is going to exist in a digital network. You could design it very easily so that it's completely impossible for government or anyone else to take your money away. Or you could design it so that it's easy for them to take your money away. Well, which one do you think the people who are in power are most likely to favor? Right. So there have been times in history when we've had major uprisings of public sentiment where people have said, you know, we're leaving England. We've had enough. We're going to have the United States of America. We don't care if you think we're your colony. We're going to dump the tea in the harbor. We're going to have this Declaration of Independence, and we're going to draw up a constitution which favors individual rights over the power of government, even to the extent that there was in the creation of the United States of America, there was this legal doctrine in the creation, which is, you know what, we'll take the risk of loss of security. It's more important to protect the rights of the individual than it is to make society safe. We have to protect the rights of the individual above all else. That was, you know, one extreme pendulum swing. Society's kind of gone the opposite way to a large extent. Most people around the world, if you tell them, look, we need a Berlin Wall around the money system. We need to stop having the current money system. It all needs to be online and digital. And the government needs the ability to be able to take it away from terrorists and bad guys at the click of a mouse anytime the government decides that's necessary. Most people around the world, George, will fairly easily be duped into thinking that's good for them.
Yeah. Right.
Government, you know, they're not going to do anything to me. I'm a good guy. It's just the bad guys they're going after. Well, right. The Berlin Wall is a perfect example, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I want to make sure that we're clear for anyone listening out there that says, well, I'll just store my cash or I'll be able to pay for things with gold. And I'm a big fan of gold. But in this scenario that you're or this picture that you're painting with your book, and with this digital currency, there is no cash. And it would be, correct me if I'm wrong, but it would be impossible to pay for anything with gold unless you were just kind of do it behind the scenes, you know, on the black market, because every business would be set up with, let's just call it a digital currency terminal, like a credit card terminal, but it just takes that digital currency. So there is no way to transact in a fiat current or in a paper currency or gold or silver. Is that, am I seeing that correctly?
Yeah, I think it's very likely. I mean, there will always be a black market no matter what. There's always criminals. But I think it's very likely that once we have government-sponsored digital currency systems, it will be declared that anyone who's trying to do any kind of business outside of the system obviously must be hiding something. So that should be illegal, right? And so it will be, well, okay, if I've got a gold coin and I want to use it to buy something from you, I've got to sell that gold coin for government approved digital currency for Orwell's, so that they can track that transaction and make sure I paid taxes on it if I had a capital gain. And then once I've got my Orwell's, I can use them to buy something from you. Well, what if I just want to give you the coin directly? My guess is that will be illegal someday.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll still happen. People will still do it, but it will probably be outlawed.
Yeah. And in your earlier point, or going back to that, you said that the modern day Berlin Wall, and I this is actually the terminology that I use, I call it the financial Berlin Wall. It's mm-hmm. It's not a physical wall around the United States, but it's so, well, if you can't take your money outside of the United States, or if you can't take your Orwell's outside of the United States, well, then how are you going to physically leave? So in essence, it's the same type of thing where the government can physically keep you within a specific border because it won't let you take your money out.
And if they have the ability to seize either temporarily or permanently your money, then as soon as you do anything they don't like, as soon as they detect that you've traveled someplace, you know, you get to the notion of needing, you know, papers, please. You've got to have your government authorization to travel. Well, George's passport expired and we didn't renew it. And he got on a sailboat in Texas and went to the Caribbean because he'd had enough of this government oversight. Well, before he got to the Caribbean, we froze all of his money because he's now a fugitive from justice. And we're not taking anything. We're just enforcing. We're making sure that he behaves the way he's supposed to. Unfortunately, you and I are probably not representative of mainstream society. Most people wouldn't have too much of an objection to that as long as they don't think that it's ever going to happen to them. It's just for criminals. It's for guys like George, these international real estate investors who are obviously trying to skirt the tax system. If he tries to get away, we got to be able to get even with him. That mentality is pretty easy to sell. And in a world where the biggest problem that we face right now is wealth inequality, it's pretty easy to sell to the masses. This guy, George, he's got investments all over the world. You know, it's got to be some kind of a tax dodge. Right. No real loyal American would ever invest in properties overseas. So this guy is obviously a bad guy. We got to be able to deal with guys like George. That's not going to be offensive to 99% of the world. It's easy to portray you as a bad guy just because you're unpatriotic by investing outside of the United States.
Yeah.
That mentality for now is pretty well accepted. I'm hoping that pendulum will swing back toward the revolutionary war mentality of the United States and the patriotism as we knew it then.
You talked about inequality. So that brings me to another question that I had. We both read that Ray Dalio paper or blog post. I think it was on LinkedIn. That was just amazing. I did a video on it and it was wildly popular. But I know that you've got a take on that as well. And I'd be really curious to hear that.
Well, basically where we stand in the history of finance right now, the way things used to work is what the stock market was all about was you're buying stock. You're basically buying, you're trading a certain amount of money in the here and now for a claim on future earnings. It's all about the future earnings potential of the companies that you're buying. That's what the whole equation comes down to. What's changed is it used to be, okay, so let's analyze the prospects of those companies to continue to produce earnings. How's the economy looking? How are their customer bases and so forth? What's happened is in the wake of the great financial crisis, central banks around the world, notably the Federal Reserve, but all around the world, are conjuring new money supply out of thin air and using it to buy government bonds. Well, who do they buy those bonds from? They, by law, they can't buy them directly from the government. They have to buy them on the open market. So they're buying those bonds from institutional investors, putting money in the hands of institutional investors. What do those institutional investors do? Buy more investments with it, mostly in the stock market. So stock market has been propelled to new heights. And in the process, we've made the cost of borrowing so much lower that it has encouraged all of these corporate buyback transactions where companies are buying their own shares using money that they raised through the junk bond market primarily. And it's creating this double asset bubble in both stocks and bonds. What Ray Dalio says in that article is, okay, there's a paradigm shift that has to come someday when you get to the point where we can't continue to just keep on inflating these dual bubbles in both the stock and bond market. Well, the question that I don't think he really addressed in that article, if I remember right, is, okay, what are the likely catalysts to bring about that phase transition? I can't remember if he called it a phase transition or a paradigm shift, one of those phrases he used, where you get to what I think will be the defining theme of the 2020s, which is one where it's no longer possible for central bank liquidity to fuel this ongoing, just seemingly limitless bid for financial assets. So you don't have the stock market. We're already at the longest bull market in recorded history. And it shows right now no sign of stopping. Why is that? Because the Fed is buying more and more of those bonds, putting more and more money in the hands of investors, making more and more cheap money available for corporate buybacks. Yeah, what's going to change it? What's going to break the cycle?
One bit here, but just quickly. And you're talking about quantitative easing. And as these asset bubbles grow, I think it's important for people to realize that it's financializing the real economy to a greater degree. And what I mean by that is that makes the real economy more and more and more dependent upon the financial economy. So you get the tail wagging the dog instead of vice versa. So then once these bubbles deflate, then that has a much greater effect on the real economy.
Well, and especially when you get these dual bubbles and they start to deflate, one of the biggest trends in institutional finance has been this idea of risk parity, which is probably the most common institutional strategy in finance. It's all based on the idea that stocks and bonds are inversely correlated. So as the stock market goes down, the bond market goes up. Well, we know for the last 10 years, we've seen stock and bond markets both going up simultaneously.
Right.
You would think that if we're seeing on the way up that that inverse correlation that used to exist no longer really holds true, you'd think people would have figured out by now that that means someday when we start to go down, we can, in fact, go down together. What most people don't realize is the way that these very mechanical institutional strategies work is the leverage that they use in the bond market. The way that they can justify that, you know, how can you use all this leverage which could create excess risk? They've got all these fancy spreadsheets which basically say, well, because we've got exposure to both stocks and bonds, and we've got the ratio set just right, what's going to happen is when those bonds, which we've got a lot of leverage on, we've levered up our bonds, when they start to go down in price, it's going to cost us something for sure because we've got a lot of leverage there. Could create some really big losses. But we know for sure the stock market's going to be going up when that happens, so it's going to make up for it. It's all going to be okay. Mm-hmm. As soon as that stops working, nobody even has to panic. Nobody has to change their mind about anything. As soon as you get both going down at the same time, the computers say, hey, that inverse correlation between stocks and bonds is no longer present in the market. We can't justify having these big levered positions on. What do we have to do? There's no choice here. We have to sell all those leveraged bond positions. What does that do? Does it pump more money into the stock market? No, I think it begins this dual sell-off where both stocks and bonds are selling off at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it creates a very difficult, a self-reinforcing, vicious cycle that I think could cause a financial crisis much bigger than the 2008 event. The question you have to ask yourself is, okay, wait a minute. That sounds interesting, but that's not what's happening right now. What's happening right now is we got stock and bonds both going up in price. And it seems like it just couldn't be better. People have been invested in stocks have been doing great. Mm-hmm. Well, what's going to be the catalyst that brings about this phase transition that Ray Dalio has talked about? I think the answer is entirely political, and I think it's probably closer at hand than most people think. And I think the way it works is politicians are going to start saying, in, you know, we've got a big election coming up. I think a big political trend is going to be politicians saying, look, wealth inequality is breaking our country apart. It's a really big deal. What's going on here? How do we get to this point? Well, how we got to this point is for the last 10 years since the great financial crisis, central bankers have figured out that they can literally conjure trillions of dollars out of thin air. Now, in the beginning, there were critics saying, don't do this, because if you do, it's going to create runaway inflation and it's going to be the end of the world. That right. didn't happen. The runaway inflation never happened. So now you can make the argument, even though I don't agree with it completely, to say, look, it's been proven that we can conjure trillions of dollars out of thin air. Central banks have proven this possible. It does not lead to runaway inflation. That's a proven fact. We got 10 years of history to show it. And what have they done with the trillions and trillions of dollars? They've given it to rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what the argument is, by buying up bonds, which are really coming from institutional investors. It's not rich people. It's a lot of pension funds and institutional investment vehicles. But the result is the stock market is the big benefactor. That means that wealthy people who own stocks are benefactors. They've done great. But everybody else on Main Street is not doing so great. And if you just imagine, if you're a politician, what a perfect opportunity this is to say, okay, so in the Reagan era, it was all supposed to be trickle down. We're going to help the rich people by reducing their taxes, but it was actually going to be a benefit to the rest of us. How did that work out? Now, the new Reagan doctrine is this quantitative easing stuff that buys these bonds up, is supposed to bring down interest rates, supposed to make the economy better. How has that really helped you, average voter? It's done great for rich people. Rich got richer. The poor got poorer. If we got trillions of dollars that central banks can conjure out of thin air, we should be giving them to you, the voter. We should be providing universal basic income. We should be providing free college tuition. We should be forgiving existing student loans. We should be providing free Medicare for everyone. We should be doing, and you list a huge list of giveaways. People love giveaways. The usual argument was, well, who the heck is going to pay for that? Who are you going to raise taxes on in order to pay for all that? And the answer is nobody. We don't have to tax anybody.
Yeah, that's
we
old
can
school
conjure
school.
This money out of thin air. Now, it's all a fallacy as far as I'm concerned, because that kind of money printing absolutely will lead to runaway inflation. But here's my prediction, George. I think that this is coming. When it comes, modern monetary theory will be the academic school of thought that will be used to justify it. But I don't think it's fair to blame the modern monetary theory people. You know, they fear inflation. The PhDs that came up with these ideas, they're worried about inflation. The politicians aren't going to be worried. They're going to say, look, this is this MMT stuff that kind of provides an academic justification. We can look empirically and see what central banks have done for the last 10 years, trillions and trillions of dollars conjured out of thin air. Did it help you and me? No, it just helped the rich people. It's time to stop helping the rich people and start helping us. My prediction, George, is this will be perceived when it happens as a terrific success for the first few years, because initially, in the beginning, you won't have the runaway inflation that is ultimately going to lead to a Great Depression, which is much worse than the Great Depression from the 1930s. It's not going to have any of those ill effects. In the beginning, inflation is always a good thing. It's only when that inflation starts to run away and suddenly nobody's money is worth anything that you really get into a problem. So I think what we're headed toward is a phase transition where the working class people say, look, we've had enough of this quantitative easing benefiting the rich people. When they say, for the benefit of the people who deserve it, damn it, we're going to have politicians who demand that any quantitative easing money go to be spent on universal basic income, not on buying government bonds. Well, wait a minute. As soon as you're not supporting financial markets, you bring on that financial market crash. And I think it's very possible that if what you're doing is there's real trouble in the stock market, S&P is down 30%, 40%, but it happens at a time when everybody just got their first universal basic income check and there's free Medicare for everybody, everybody's going to say, you know what? The hell with the rich people. Let their stock market crash. The hell with them. That's not good for the world. We need the stock market because it represents the equity of the companies that run the economy. We can't let the bond market crash because that literally is the funding source for the entire economy. But I think we could get to an environment where politicians are saying, no, we're not going to keep bailing out the fat cats on Wall Street. We're going to bail out Main Street. That will be so politically popular that I think they could let financial markets go for a while. Eventually, it leads to runaway inflation, and you've got just a hell of a problem. But it won't be a bad thing in the beginning. At first, everybody will be getting free stuff, and it'll seem like, hey, we didn't have to raise anybody's taxes. I got universal basic income. My kid doesn't have to pay back their student loans. This is great. And it will feel great to most people in the beginning. And it's a setup for a colossal late 2020s economic Armageddon, frankly. But in the beginning, it's going to feel great.
Right. So a couple points I want to make there. First and foremost, when you talked about MMT and the politicians taking that from the people who have actually engineered it, that's the same thing they did with Keynesian economics. Most people think that Keynesian economics is what we see the politicians talk about now, but it's not. In fact, I remember watching Milton Friedman videos where he said that if Keynes was actually alive and saw what people are calling Keynesian economics, he'd have a heart attack.
I think you're exactly right that the MMT inventors are going to be they're going to be scapegoated exactly the way Keynes has been scapegoated. Keynes didn't say print money like crazy and never pay it back. He said, pay it back. And the MMT people, the academics that have come up with it, are not saying don't fear inflation. They're saying fear inflation in a big way and watch it very carefully. The way it's going to be bastardized is politicians will take it and say, this is a justification for us to use quantitative easing to fund massive social spending to buy votes. And it's eventually going to bankrupt the economy, but it won't happen right away. And it's going to feel really good for a while. And I think that unfortunately it's inevitable at this point. And it's inevitable. I think we have to acknowledge the people who are frustrated about wealth inequality in this country and elsewhere in the world are absolutely right. You know, what capitalism used to be when you and I were kids, George, it was the idea that doesn't matter if you're just a poor immigrant and your family is nobody. Anybody can start a business. Anybody can become a millionaire. Anybody who's willing to work hard enough. You don't have to have a whole bunch of assets to start with. You don't have to be from the right family. Anybody who's willing to work hard can become successful. And that system of incentives that made it possible for people to work hard and create businesses and create employment and create prosperity is what made the United States what it is. That's what capitalism was supposed to be. It has become this corrupt system where, frankly, the Wall Street banks have captured the regulators. The regulators work for them rather than policing them. And they've captured the politicians, and they've managed to lobby for policies that help the bankers, and they've created this ridiculous wealth inequality situation. So we have ourselves, we only have ourselves to blame for this situation that's been created. And I think that investors are going to be in for a hell of a ride and before the 2020s are out.
And I think going back to Friedman, he was the one that said that the most important, with capitalism, you have profit and you have loss, but loss is actually a lot more important than the profit.
And if you try to take the risk out of capitalism and you're bailing out the people, you know, people take risk, they win some, they profit. They lose some, they persuade politicians to bail them out. That's not capitalism. That is a utterly corrupt system, which is what we've come to. And you look at the whole financial crisis, it came from the utter corruption of mortgage lending. The entire industry was jokingly referring to the most common financial product as a liar loan because they knew that the people that were borrowing the money couldn't possibly pay it back. And they lent the money to them anyway because it wasn't their money. And they knew that the buyers of those bonds would be the suckers in the end. We've gotten to this system that's so utterly corrupt. Nobody ever went to jail for that. Actually, that's not true. There were victims of that event. The people that got the mortgages they couldn't afford staged a big protest outside of Bank of America in Los Angeles. A whole bunch of them were both arrested and put in jail and roughed up by police in the process. So the victims of those financial crimes were put in jail, but none of the perpetrators were. And it's no surprise that people are angry. And I think that their anger has been brewing and growing for the last decade, and it's about to blow over. And when it does, I think we're going to see a huge amount of quantitative easing used to facilitate a bunch of social spending, which will ultimately result in malinvestment and runaway inflation. So it's going to be a scary time.
Yeah, QE for the people. So I think what a lot of people have a hard time understanding, Eric, and maybe you can explain this, is why the Fed can increase their balance sheet, can take it to $4 trillion, can do all this quantitative easing, and it doesn't produce inflation. But if they did it the other way and put it into the real economy, how it would produce inflation. Can you connect those dots for us?
Well, the answer is that if you conjure trillions of dollars out of thin air, it always, always produces inflation. The thing is, if you conjure those trillions of dollars out of thin air and you use them to buy bonds from institutional investors, then the inflation that you're creating is an inflation in financial asset markets. And that has definitely occurred. We've had the biggest bull market in both stocks and bonds over the last 10 years in recorded history. And we're at 5,000-year lows by some measures on interest rates. Well, how is that possible? It's because there's been a massive inflation of asset prices.
Right.
If you start to use the same mechanism to conjure trillions of dollars out of thin air, but instead you give it to the people so that they can spend it in the real economy, now you're taking those trillions of dollars and you're not pumping them into asset markets through the quantitative easing mechanism that's been used before, but you're pumping it into the real economy. On one hand, it certainly is true that you're helping real working citizens as opposed to bankers when you do that. But that means that the money is going into the real economy and it produces price inflation in the real economy and all of the problems that are inherent to that. So I think we're going to have an inflation problem that's much worse than the inflation problem of the 1970s, but it won't happen overnight. First, this will be perceived as a great success. When they first start pumping trillions of dollars into the real economy, it's going to feel great. The economy is going to be strong. Everybody's going to be happier. They've got a new source of income from a government-sponsored check. Everybody feels great. There's no free lunch. Ultimately, there has to be a consequence for that. And the consequence will be runaway inflation, but it won't happen overnight. And there will be enough time for this new policy regime to be perceived as such a wild success that it will just be embraced and, you know, everybody will want to do more of it. And then we'll get probably in the mid to late 2020s into a really, really scary situation.
Yeah. So my next questions would be, number one, why couldn't they increase interest rates? I mean, I know why, but I think that would be the pushback from a central banker. Well, we'll just increase interest rates. Or the feedback that I get from a lot of the people who watch the channel is, well, okay, Eric, I get what you're saying, but why can't we just be Japan? Japan's been doing it for 30 years. So why is the United States any different? Why can't we go down that road?
Well, first of all, if you were to increase interest rates to combat inflation, immediately you would bankrupt the U.S. government. The U.S. government is now 23 trillion dollars in debt. It is impossible for the U.S. to service that much debt unless you have these epic low interest rates. So interest rates have to stay as low as they are now, because it wouldn't be possible to service the debt otherwise. So that's why we're stuck with low interest rates. Can you continue to have very low interest rates and still get away with pumping money into the real economy? You can for a few years. Eventually, it's going to produce runaway inflation, and you'll be unable to fight that runaway inflation with the usual mechanism of increasing interest rates, because doing so would bankrupt the federal government. So you get into this ultimate liquidity trap at some point, where you can't get out of it with higher interest rates or printing more money. And, you know, it's not until you get the runaway inflation that it really becomes a problem.
And I want to be clear on that, too, because a lot of people push back and say, well, Eric, you're talking about the market going down or interest rates going up. Well, the Fed can take care of that. They can just print more money. But to your point, the Fed paints themselves into a corner where if we do get inflation, that's their kryptonite. Once we start getting inflation, then they can't print any more money. Then they've lost the only tool that they have in their toolbox. So what does the Fed do if they're completely impotent? They can't print money. Then, because if they do print money, it just exacerbates the problem.
And I think, as you said earlier, the way the corruption of MMT will occur is the proponents of MMT, the PhDs that came up with these ideas, are going to say, look, right now we have room to do a whole bunch of fiscal stimulus without causing any runaway inflation. So let's do it. And then the politicians say, yeah, let's do it. Another year or two go by, and those same PhDs suddenly raise their hands and say, wait a minute, our whole theory here is predicated on the idea that what makes this okay is as long as you don't produce runaway inflation. Inflation is ticking up. We're seeing incipient signs that inflation could become a problem. We got to stop doing this stuff, because otherwise it's going to be a problem. And the Stephanie Keltons of the world are going to be the first to stand up and say, it's time to stop. Remember, we told you there would be a time to stop. It's when you get an inflation problem, that's when you got to stop. Now's that time, stop. Politicians are going to say, okay, sideline that lady. We'll find somebody else that will support what we want to do. Let's
take
keep printing
Orwell
money.
Quick, take away her Orwells.
Yeah, exactly.
You've interviewed some of the smartest people on the planet Earth. I mean, I could go down the list, but I wanted to make sure that I got your take on the biggest lesson or lessons that you've learned from interviewing all these people, and how have you implemented that in your own investing strategy?
Wow, excellent question. The best way I can answer that is, in the beginning, I was looking for the guru, the one guy who's so smart that they've just got all the answers and they've got it all right. There is no one guru who's got it all. When you can identify a list of gurus, some really smart people with competing ideas, and that's what I really try to look for now, is if I find an absolute genius like a Jeff Snyder, who's talking about the commercial euro dollar system and why it's creating this global US dollar liquidity squeeze, immediately I want to go and find somebody just as smart on the other side of that argument, because I know that financial markets are complex systems that are impossible to accurately predict far in advance what's going to happen. What you want to do is you want to have the most informed viewpoints on both sides of every argument, so that as the news starts to actually unfold in the market and you see what's really happening. A perfect example, right now, I really have been feeling for the last year or 2 years, I'm not sure how long, Jeff Snyder's got the US dollar figured out. Everybody was saying the US dollar's got to go down. It's got to go down. It's got to go down. Jeff Snyder's saying, here's the reasons that, even though it's not bullish in the sense of healthy economy, here's the reasons the dollar squeeze is going to continue to push it higher. Well, if I just said, okay, Jeff's my hero, I'm only going to listen to him, everybody else is wrong, I'd be screwed. What you've got to do is be saying, okay, let's talk to a Keith McCullough. Let's talk to a Luke Groman. Let's talk to Julia DeClercq. Let's get the other perspective on the dollar so that when the direction of the tape changes, which is what's just happened in the last few months here, it's like, okay, I still think Jeff is a genius. Now, Jeff's genius is not working right now in terms of the dollar index. Now, there's a lot of reasons if you look a little more carefully. You say, wait a minute, the dollar index is unduly weighted primarily by the euro. I don't really use the trade-weighted dollar index because there's no instrument to trade it with. You can't buy and sell trade-weighted dollar index futures like you can DXY futures. Mm-hmm. But Jeff's story is really coming true more on the trade-weighted dollar index than it is on the DXY. So, okay, now I can understand why Jeff is still right in terms of his macro view. But as far as what the DXY is doing, it's really this recovery in the euro, which is more politically driven, that explains why we've seen this reversal in the DXY. Okay, so I think the biggest lesson that I've learned is don't have any one hero in the market. Anybody who really impresses you, the very first thing you want to do is say, okay, how do I find another person who's just as smart, who has the opposite view, so I can understand both sides of this argument at a level that is more sophisticated than I ever could have figured out on my own. I've got the Keith McCullough view, which is very dollar bearish, as is Luke Groman's. I've got the Jeff Snyder view. I understand all of them, and now as I watch things actually unfold in the market, I can benefit from all of those insights and try to figure out what's happening.
And come to your own conclusion. Right.
Exactly. Well, and also to let the market tell me. The biggest lesson that I've learned is the market's going to do what the market is going to do. And one of the things that the market does is it gets it wrong when enough. I mean, the market is just a reflection of people voting with their trades. Right. If Jeff is absolutely right that the dollar has to go higher, but there's a whole bunch of people who are not smart enough to understand Jeff who are selling dollar futures because they don't understand, that's going to cause the dollar to go lower, at least initially, because of all that selling. So, you know, what does the herd think? What is the market doing? You've got to realize that the benefit of really smart people who have really brilliant economic views, it's only in trying to stay ahead of what the herd is going to figure out. The herd is going to do stupid herd-like things along the way. So Jeff can be totally right that the dollar has to move higher. The herd can take it lower based on momentum alone. And, you know, you've got to be ready for that. So you've got to let the market tell you what the market wants to do next.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I got to ask you, how difficult is it to interview Jeff Snyder? The reason I say that, for those of you who haven't listened to Macro Voices, you got to start right now. But Jeff is, his intellect, and not only that, but the verbiage that he uses is so esoteric, and his intellect is so high that it's in. I really appreciate where you come from, because a lot of times you're just kind of listening to what Jeff says and then kind of translating it into English for even people like your listeners who are. Most of them are extremely sophisticated in their own right, but I don't think they can even follow really what Jeff is talking about. So how challenging is that?
Well, it is a challenge, but what I find is with the different guests that we have on the program, especially the regulars, it's a completely different task for me. Most of what I do with Jeff, I never could keep up with Jeff enough to really be probing and challenging his thinking. He tells me what subjects we're going to cover. He gives me an outline. He gives me kind of a bullet list of what questions to ask him about, because he's prepared slides to talk about them. What I can offer in terms of my talent, my contribution or value added, is translating what he says to English that a larger percentage of the audience is going to be able to understand. There are other guests where I don't think they're really inclined to talk about the issues that are important unless I guide them to the right issues. And so there are some people where my job as the interviewer is to get them onto what's important. There's other people where they already know better than I do how to get to what's important. My job is to translate it so the audience can understand it.
Yeah.
So it really depends on who it is and what the topic is. And you know, we've had a lot of really terrific guests on the show. And I think the unsung hero of Macro Voices, a lot of people don't realize, Patrick Ceresna, my co-host, is not just on the air. He's the guy who's actually negotiating with all of the guests to get them to agree to come on the show. And, you know, we've got people like Ray Dalio that we want to get that have not agreed to do an interview with us yet. But for the people that he has gotten, he's got, you know, people like Chris Cole. I mean, just brilliant and very prescient in his views. We got him coming back in February. We get more requests for bring back Chris Cole than anything else. So I don't think there's any one particular lesson that I have to share with you. It really depends on who the guest is as far as what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I've got to ask you, what do you think interest rates are going to be doing in 2020? I think that's such a huge component of trying to figure out not only the dollar, but gold and everything else. It kind of starts with rates. You have any opinion on that?
Well, George, I think the key point to understand, and Ray Dalio underscores this, is interest rates cannot go a whole lot higher because it would bankrupt the U.S. federal government if they did. So what that means to me is I think the 10-year yield probably has to have a cap on it of about 3.5%. That's a lot higher than we are now at below 2%. It's back to where we were a year ago. So we can go back to that. And I don't know what's going to happen. It's a question of policy and economy and a lot of stuff. I don't really have any predictions. But we can't go substantially more than that. I don't think we can go a lot higher than 3% and certainly not past 3.5% on the 10-year yield. So that's a cap. But inflation is going to continue to pick up. And eventually, we're going to get to the point where in order to combat that inflation, you would need to increase interest rates, nominal interest rates, well above 3.5% on the 10-year, and they're not going to be able to do it. And that's where we get to a fiscal crisis for the U.S. government. That's still several years off. As Ray Dalio predicts, I think what happens is they keep interest rates low, as they have, to allow this economic condition that we have to continue. If they were to allow interest rates to back up substantially, that means a big sell-off in the bond market, potentially sparks the unwind of the risk parity trade, which is major in institutional finance. Just so many negative consequences and feedback loops that could be triggered by substantially higher. By substantially higher, I mean above 3.5 on the 10-year yield.
It sounds crazy when you say substantially. That's above 3.5 when historically rates.
But historically, 3.5 is super low, right?
Yeah.
So exactly. we're stuck, and you know the thing to remember is, it's so easy to say, okay, we're stuck in this liquidity trap. We've got super low interest rates. There's no way out. Oh my God, the sky is falling. Well, how many decades has Japan been in that situation? You can be in that situation of stuck with super low interest rates without the sky falling for decades at a time. And I think that really is the best metaphor, is we're turning Japanese. We're going to be stuck as Japan has been with very, very low interest rates, economic stagnation. Eventually, we'll have an inflation problem. The inflation problem won't be severe until we are spending quantitative easing money into the real economy with some kind of social spending, whether it's universal basic income or something. That's the point where we're really going to get into an inflation problem. When you do get the inflation problem, they won't be able to fight it. One of the things Paul Volcker said before he died is, forget about using what I did in the 80s to fight inflation. That won't work anymore. The U.S. was not a creditor nation at that point, but pretty close to it. The debt of the United States was not a big deal in right. the late 70s and early 80s when Paul Volcker took the sledgehammer approach to interest rates to solve the inflation problem. That won't work this time. Volcker himself said so. So the where this all goes haywire is when we have the runaway inflation problem that would demand much higher policy interest rates, which we cannot deliver because it would bankrupt the government. You know, people could have predicted that Japan would have that kind of inflation and that it would bring their whole situation to an end. Probably there were smart people predicting that 20 years ago. Well, it's 20 years later. It hasn't happened yet. The question is, if you can get away with economic stagnation, kind of a lousy economy they've had in Japan for the last 20 years, but no runaway inflation, maybe there's nothing to worry about. Well, maybe there is nothing to worry about until you start printing money like it's going out of style and forgiving student loans and giving away universal basic income and all this stuff that's going to be directly and immediately spent into the real economy. That's where your runaway inflation would come from. And yeah. But we're not there yet, but I think that's where we're headed in the coming decade. Certainly not this month or even this year, but in the coming decade, I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah, that's great. And I the points that I want to
make... No, it's not great, George. Well, there's nothing great about it.
Well, the way you articulate it, I think, is great. I think for the average person that's watching this, they're saying to themselves, okay, I understand what Erica's saying, but I want to try to find a catalyst. You know, what's the catalyst? And if you look at the Japan situation, they've got a 30% savings rate there. And I was reading actually this morning I was doing some research on another video. And at certain years between 1990, I believe it was 1991, and today, their savings rate has exceeded 40%. 40%. So that means that even if Japan does MMT, there's going to be no velocity because people don't spend the money. They just put it right back in the bank and or under their mattress. Where in the United States, where we've got, let's say, a 2 or 3% savings rate, when you do that MMT or that helicopter money, that QE for the people, we're not going to tuck that under the mattress. The Americans are going to go straight to Walmart, straight to Target, straight to the Ford dealership, and they're going to spend that money. So I think if I'm an average Joe American that's listening to what you're saying and trying to figure out that catalyst or the potential catalyst, and again, there's no certainties, there's only probabilities, but that would be MMT in the United States or helicopter money. Once they start doing that, I know that it might not happen right away, but within a couple of years, I need to be concerned, and I need to understand that there's a good potential for inflation to be on the horizon.
Yeah, and I think that when you see helicopter money, whether it's universal basic income or free college tuition or whatever it is, it's not time to, well, it is time to panic in the long term, but it's not time to get worried about the sky falling right away. What will happen next after that will feel really, really good, not bad. And that will just embolden the policymakers behind it to do more and more of it. There's a lag there. Eventually, it will result in a runaway inflation that will be impossible to fight, and it'll lead to an inflationary greater depression that's worse than the 1930s depression that will probably happen in the second half of the 2020s. But when you see the helicopter money coming, it's not time to say, oh my God, Eric said this is the signal, the sky's about to fall. It's not about to fall. It's about to feel great for a little while. You know, that's think of the helicopter money as the heroin shot. You're getting shot up full of heroin. You're going to feel really, really good for a while until you get on the downside, which actually might kill you. And I think that's probably the analogy. So, yeah. And the other thing that I think is important to realize, you know, gold investors get so excited. I don't understand this. People are saying, this is going to be great. My gold is going to, when this stuff he's talking about happens, my gold is going to soar. It's going to be worth $10,000 an ounce. Yeah, it probably is going to be worth $10,000 an ounce. It's nothing to celebrate. It's going to be worth $10,000 an ounce when the $10,000 are not worth very much. The ounce of gold will be worth the same as it is today. It'll buy the same amount of stuff in terms of purchasing power. It will be the money. And the thing is, you got, let's say at $1,500 today, you've got an ounce of gold. You think that it's going to go to $15,000 before the 2020s are out. And I think that's an entirely possible prediction. Okay, that's not a great thing, because the gold is still going to, you know, $15,000 will buy the same amount of food and iPads and stuff like that as it does today. But when you sell that gold, you're going to pay a capital gains tax on that supposedly huge windfall profit.
Right.
And you're not going to have $15,000 at the end of the day. You're going to have, you know, $8,000 or something after you paid all your taxes. There will probably be a windfall profits tax on precious metals specifically, because gold investors will be, you know, demonized as the bad guys who skirted the system. And once you've paid your taxes, now you've got $8,000, which buys the same as $700 bought today. It could be much better if the price of gold went down from here. That would mean that my predictions about bad stuff happening to the economy didn't really happen. You know, gold is not really a get-rich asset. It's a stay-rich asset when the money it's denominated in collapses in price. If the money it's denominated in is collapsing in price, it means really, really bad things are happening in the general economy. And unfortunately, I think we are headed toward that in the next 10 years, but not right away. And when it starts, it'll start good. The inflation that comes from helicopter money is going to feel great at first. And a few years later, ask me then.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a great way to put it. It's not a get-rich asset. It's a stay-rich asset. I think I'm going to have to steal that one from you, Eric. I always tell people that I never really look at gold as an investment or even a speculation. I maybe look at the miners as a speculation, but gold in and of itself, I see it just as an insurance policy. It's just it's just to maintain your purchasing power. It's a store of value. That's what it is.
But, you know, by the time that the predictions that we're talking about were to actually come true, you know, gold's not going to $15,000 this year. By the end of this decade, it's quite possible. But that Orwell currency that tracks every aspect of everything you do and taxes gold sales at a higher rate than other assets might just be in place by then, and you might be required to use it. So, you know, I don't think that gold investors are going to get a free ride that the rest of society doesn't get. Just because you were smart enough to know that gold is the asset that will benefit in terms of its nominal price the most doesn't mean that you're going to be allowed to benefit as much as you want to. You're going to be targeted as these gold investors. They made a killing when everybody else was suffering. We got to tax those bastards and let's get them. And, you'll pay for your gold speculation that way.
The way I look at gold is I see that as an insurance policy. But if that insurance policy, there's a high likelihood that that might not pan out in a worst case scenario, and I'm not able to retain that purchasing power because it's confiscated, or I just can't use it at the risk of going to prison for 10 years. Let's say, I know what I do personally, which is I like to diversify what I call my political risk and my currency risk by spending most of my time outside the United States. But for most Americans, you know, they got kids, they got soccer practice, they've got a job. It's just not realistic. I mean, what on earth do they do?
Well, unfortunately, you've got to understand the big picture here. As you said earlier, we've had a highly financialized economy for the last few decades. Eventually, this is all going to come to a head, and we're going to realize that the real purchasing power value that exists is a lot less than all of the balances that exist on ledgers and in balance sheets and on books someplace. And when things get really tough, what will happen is money will be taken away from whoever has it in order. You know, as a society, we have to service feeding people, not letting people starve. The most basic human needs are going to come first. If we get into an inflationary Great Depression, the primary goals of government are going to be to satisfy the basic shelter and food needs of the largest possible population. Anybody who has outsmarted the system by figuring out what asset to buy, whether it's Bitcoin or gold or, you know, who knows what, that money is going to be targeted as, okay, we need to take the money for the greater good of society away from George and give it to, you know, buying food for the masses. And unfortunately, I think we're headed in this world of surveillance capitalism that we already live in, and probably moving toward, in the digital currency revolution, eventually more government control over the electronic money system itself. We're moving into an environment where it won't be possible to hide anything. You know, okay, you got your gold. You can't buy anything with your gold unless you convert it into government-approved currency first, and you're going to have to pay a tax when you do that. So, and of course, there will always be a black market for criminals, but then you've got the question of whether you want to be a criminal in order to protect your wealth. I don't think that when things get really bad, if things get as bad as I fear they could, it's going to matter that much. Whoever's got wealth is going to have it taken away from them in order to feed the starving people, of which we will have plenty.
And because of the Orwell and the financial Berlin Wall, you're stuck. If you're if you're one of those people with a target on your back or a target on your wealth, with the Orwell and the financial Berlin Wall, they're going to take it from you. You don't have you have no recourse. You have no there's really nothing you can do without risking breaking the law. You're screwed.
And I want to be super clear though, before, because I don't want to cause anybody to panic here. I think the things that we're predicting here, George, are inevitable, but that does not mean that they're imminent. I think they're probably many years away. What's coming next is eventually we'll get to some kind of social spending with quantitative easing money, helicopter money. It's going to have a really positive economic impact at first. It'll probably take us at least a couple of years. Eventually, we get that runaway inflation problem, and we don't have any good way of solving it, and we're really screwed. I don't know how long that takes. It's probably several years. These things generally take longer than most smart people think possible in order to resolve themselves. But eventually, we get to the point where this financialized economy and this massive run-up in asset prices that's happened in the wake of the great financial crisis because of all this quantitative easing. It was all fueled. It wasn't because of sound economics. It didn't happen because the economy was so great and there was organic growth in corporate earnings that made possible this great expansion of wealth. That's not how it happened. It happened through central bank liquidity. And at some point, I don't think that they have to. There's really no reason, as the MMT people correctly state, there's no reason that they have to turn the spigot off until we have a serious runaway inflation problem. And we're nowhere close to that yet. It's coming, and inflation's already ticking up. And inflation is one of those things that tends to creep up on you very, very slowly, and then all at once. You know, it's all of a sudden that cracking iceberg where it's like, holy cow, what just happened? And we've got a major crisis. And I think that by then it will be too late to do very much about it. And probably what there really has to be at some point is some kind of debt jubilee. We'll realize that the overall financial system is just too indebted. It's not possible to continue unless we have a reset. That reset can come through great inflation. You know, you debase the value of money to the point where the owners of debt, the owners of debt securities, end up just taking a huge haircut and getting screwed. Well, the thing is, remember, it sounds like that's just the rich fat cats. It's not. It's pension funds. The people who are going to lose are all of the savers, all of the people with pensions. And you know, how are we going to fund the? We've already got a huge problem with retiring baby boomers. They didn't save for their retirement. Social Security is underfunded. And eventually, we're going to have a revolt where the younger generation say, wait a minute. Ever since the 1970s, on the 60 Minutes TV show, these boomers were told, your Social Security system is underfunded. It's going to go bankrupt by the 2020s.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't do anything about it. And now it's the 2020s and it's bankrupt. And you expect me, the 30-year-old, to, not me, unfortunately, but them, the 30-year-old.
You're 31. I won't tell anybody, Eric.
Right. You're expecting, you know, us 20 and 30-somethings to pay a much, much larger percentage of our income into a system that is necessary only because we've got to bail you, the baby boomers, out of the fact that you didn't spend an adequate percentage of your income during your working years actually funding a system that would save money and that would work and that would be able to do the things that it was designed to do. So now you guys were paying, you know, 6 or 7% Social Security on your wages. You want me to pay 25% because I've got to take care of you? No thanks. Uh-uh. Well, what's the alternative? Let all of the aging baby boomers, you know, starve in the streets with no place, no money for retirement and no way to pay for their medical bills? I think as a humanitarian society, we can't let that happen. Well, who's going to pay for it? Initially, I think the answer is very clear. Quantitative easing. We'll conjure the money out of thin air in order to pay for boomer retirements to bail out the Social Security system so that we don't have to tax younger generations. Eventually, that's going to contribute to the runaway inflation of the late 2020s. Maybe it's even the 2030s. I don't know. Eventually, we run into a runaway inflation problem. And it's runaway inflation is where the music stops. It's when you get to runaway inflation that central bankers can't save the day anymore. And we're nowhere close to there yet. A lot of people predicted in the beginning of quantitative easing in 2009 that within a year we'd have a worse than the 70s inflation problem. Hasn't happened. Well, if you think about it, it did happen. It happened in asset markets. Well, that was a good place. Everybody's happy about that. It's when you have inflation in the general economy that you get into a real societal problem. I think what's going to get us there is spending printed money on programs like universal basic income that deliver money directly into the broader economy. And the irony is the people who are saying, hey, enough is enough. We've been printing trillions of dollars out of thin air to bail out the rich guys. It's time to take care of Main Street. They're right. It is time to take care of Main Street. But if you print money and give it to them with free college tuition and universal basic income and all this stuff, it's going to cause a runaway inflation that cripples the entire economy. People are not going to understand that. And when they start doing it and people make that criticism, say, look, if you do this, it's going to lead to a runaway inflation. The immediate response is going to be, that's what they said in 2009. With the first quantitative easing. And it didn't. It didn't. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, you know, we started doing this, let's say, in, you know, 2022 or something. And come 2023, the economy's done nothing but get much better. And there hasn't been a runaway inflation. Inflationists, you're all full of crap.
Yeah,
and
right.
They're going to look like they're right initially in the beginning. Yeah.
They'll translate that as to, okay, what Eric's saying is that $4 trillion for Wall Street, well, that's good, but $4 trillion for Main Street, well, that's bad. That's the takeaway message that the politicians will sell. You know, that'll be out there for sure.
Well, and the thing, too, is that a lot of people think, and I think incorrectly, well, we've got to hope that the politicians are smart enough to understand this stuff. It's not that the politicians don't understand it. They don't care. It's like, okay, I can print trillions of dollars out of thin air, and it's going to cause massive problems for the next guy after I'm out of office.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, if you look at especially the Democratic debates, I mean, it's just a matter of who can give away the most free stuff. So it's not outrageous to think that in 5 years, 6 years, that we'll be giving away a lot more free stuff than we are right now, and that will just compound. And
it will have a positive impact at first.
Yeah, but then they'll do it more. So if it's $1,000 of UBI right now, well, if they don't see anything happening in 2 years, well, why not take it to 4,000? Why not take it to 5,000? Yeah, exactly. And then they just cross that line in the sand where the inflation genie's out of the bottle, and then it's game over. But okay, so let's try to end on a positive note here. If you think that we go through this inflationary depression, I think that's a great way to look at it. And so many people think that those two things can't coexist, but they absolutely can. So we go through this inflationary greater depression. Do you think there's a point where we just hit the reset button and the whole world says, okay, we're done with this, we understand the mistakes, and then that pendulum goes all the way back to where it was in, you know, when America was founded, and we kind of shoot off to the next phase? Is that a possibility? Trying to end on a positive note here.
Well, I say, I thought you wanted to end on a positive note. What history teaches us about this, George, is the way these big resets happen, when you get to untenable economic situations where it just can't work, as existed in Germany in the 1930s, when the reparations for World War I could not possibly be repaid, and everybody in Germany knew that there was no rational way that their economy was ever going to recover because of the debt burden that was created by the World War I reparations.
Yeah.
What happens is people who are otherwise reasonable, you know, Germans are really smart, famous for engineering. People who are otherwise reasonable start to just turn crazy, and you get wars that don't make any sense. I think that the way you get a total financial reset is when the world recognizes that the U.S. dollar hegemony has reached a point where it can't continue, and you get a major war, and China and Russia try to take over the global economy and oust the United States. If you look at the regime change, you know, the British Empire was the most powerful military force and economic force on Earth before World War I. Then between the world wars, there was kind of a handing off of the baton. After World War II, since World War II, it's been clear the United States is the unquestioned military and economic leader of the world. If you look at long-term history of how long these global reserve currencies last, it's about time for the U.S. dollar to be replaced as the world's global reserve currency with something else. And usually the way that global reserve currencies get replaced is with a military and hegemonic power change. So logically, it would make sense to say, okay, you went from, you know, Spain to Portugal to the British Empire to the American economic and military hegemony. Maybe China, Russia, or some combination of the two is next to hold that top dog seat in the world for the next 80 to 100 years. Could it be that some major war between the U.S. and China or the U.S. and Russia is going to happen in the next 20 years that's going to be the turning point, as World War II was, between the British Empire and the American hegemonic era? It's possible. I hope it doesn't go that way. My Mandarin is only a few words, and I would not look forward to.
You have to do macro voice in Mandarin.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Eric, I really appreciate your time. The takeaway that I want everyone, I'm going to try to spin it into something positive. And that's really what you said, and what you've learned so much from doing the Macro Voices podcast, is you've got to listen to really smart people like Eric, like Jeff Snyder, like Luke Groman, all the people that you have on your podcast on a weekly basis. You got to listen to these people and come to your own conclusions. But if you're just sitting home watching TV and trying to ignore this ignorance is bliss, then you could potentially get just blindsided. And so the solution, or the best solution, is to listen to Macro Voices every single week, every single new podcast, and do exactly what Eric's done by taking all of this intellect, absorbing it, and making your own decisions from there.
and learn as much as you can about all of this. You know, there's lots of smart people out there with a lot of contrasting views. A lot of people would tell you what I've said today is crazy. Assimilate all of the different views and then interpret the news as it happens and know what you're watching for. The big signposts that I think we should be watching for are when we get a regime shift from government conjures money out of thin air to spend it on buying bonds from investors. When that switches to government spends that money on programs basically designed to buy votes.
Okay, Eric. So other than going to iTunes right now and subscribing to the podcast or going to your website, which is macrovoices.com, and buying your book, they can buy it there, can't they?
Yeah, the best place to go is macrovoices.com/BB for Beyond Blockchain. That has all of the purchasing options for the paperback, the Kindle book, or the audio book. If you go to Amazon, you can get the Kindle or the paperback, but they don't have the audio book on Amazon.
Okay. Eric, well, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, George. Congratulations on the new channel.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.